Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Today, it's our weekly news roundup where we discuss some of the regional stories making headlines this week. We had some light rain this week, but Cape Cod and Nantucket remain under drought conditions. And Governor Maura Healey was in Barnstable yesterday to unveil a 25-year plan to protect biodiversity. CAI's Jeanette Barnes is here with those stories. Hi, Jeanette.
Hi, Mindy.
So first, the drought. Cape Cod is experiencing what the state classifies as a significant drought. How unusual is that?
Well, it's not unusual to be in a drought at some point in the year, but the Cape has had a drought at some level since last fall. And that term, significant drought, is the term for a level 2 drought in the state system that is on a scale from 0 to 4. So it's kind of a medium state of drought. Nantucket right now is in a mild drought, level 1, and the rest of the state is actually considered normal. We know that the early part of the summer in our region was very dry. It continues to be pretty dry. It was also hot. The state says average temperatures in July were between 2 and 5 degrees above normal.
Oh, it's so frustrating when you see that rain stop at the canal. Everybody else gets it, but us.
Yeah.
You talked with some farmers about how this is affecting them. What did you hear?
Kind of a mixed bag, and it depends on how much irrigation they're able to do. At Coonamasset Farm in East Falmouth, most of the farm is irrigated, but I talked with the owner and farmer there, Ron Smolowitz, and he said some of his pumpkin plants are not doing that well because the irrigation system doesn't go all the way out to that part of the farm. He also said it's not just the lack of rain, but also the heat that is a problem. It's been so much heat that his tomatoes actually have sunburn. This was something I had never heard of before, but tomatoes can actually get blemishes from too much sun. And he said that lowers their value.
Yeah. So rainfall down, you mentioned the heat, but those aren't the only factors in the drought, right?
Right. So those, at least they're not the only factors in the way the drought is measured by the scientists. Another big thing that goes into it is monitoring how much water is in the groundwater wells. I interviewed Rob Magnia for this story. He's a senior hydrologist with the National Weather Service. He talked about how the extended drought on the Cape, which again has been happening since the fall, he believes that the one of the main reasons, if not the main reason, that the Cape hasn't recovered is because of the amount of water in the groundwater wells. He said that part of the pressure on those wells does come from agriculture because of the watering. Again, so, you know, using a lot of water for irrigation reduces the amount of water in those wells.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's talk about the governor's announcement yesterday. Governor Healey held an event in Barnstable to unveil goals for biodiversity. Tell us more about what that entails.
Sure. So if you remember, a few years ago, the state released a 2050 climate plan with all kinds of goals. And this is a little bit like that. It's a 2050 plan for protecting nature and wildlife, especially habitat, over the next 25 years. I can kind of hear in my head a friend of mine who's a political reporter saying, well, it's easy to set 25-year goals if you are no longer going to be in office when the deadline for that comes due. But there are also some interim, shorter-term goals here for 5 years out and 15 years. For example, land and water conservation are a big part of this plan. The state wants to reach 30% of all land and water in protection by 2030. So that's just 5 years from now. And then 40% protected by 2050. And according to the governor's office, that would really entail doubling the rate of land conservation that we're doing now.
Wow. All right. So what else is in the plan?
Well, restoring habitat that's been impaired is another big part of it. The state set a goal to remove at least 10% of dams, which, of course, is better for fish and other wildlife. And the plan also calls for making changes to culverts, like improving them, enlarging them, things like that. Over 2,500 culverts, and that is to promote the passage of fish and wildlife through those spaces. This plan also talks about some less concrete things like supporting programs that would help people connect people, and especially young people, to nature.
All right. So tell us a little bit about what the event was like and where she made the announcement.
Sure. Yeah. Healy spoke at the Long Pasture Wildlife Sanctuary, which is owned by Mass Audubon. It's in Barnstable. It was a strong turnout. I did not do a head count, but it kind of felt like a who's who of some of the environmental groups on the Cape. You know, Barnstable Land Trust was there, the Association to Preserve Cape Cod, Mass Audubon, the Atlantic White Shark Conservancy, and others. And there were state officials there as well, the Commissioner of Fish and Game, Tom O'Shea, who people said was really very instrumental in creating this plan. The state's environmental secretary, Rebecca Tepper, was there also. Some of them did a walking tour of the property there, of the sanctuary, while they were waiting for the governor to arrive. Then she gave her remarks. It was kind of a nice overlook there, looking out at the water behind the governor, and the other officials spoke as well there.
Yeah. All right. And so from your reporting, it sounds like these goals for 2050 are pretty ambitious.
Well, certainly the governor and the supporters of this plan are saying that it's ambitious. The president of Mass Audubon, David O'Neill, made some remarks. He says these are first in the nation targets for biodiversity that other states will be looking to see how Massachusetts is leading the way on that. Mass Audubon, where this event was held yesterday, has pledged $5 million toward habitat protection as part of this this initiative. And actually, that's another thing to mention, is that the state wants this to be to include public-private partnerships to meet these goals. It's not all going to be public money. So Governor Healy said Mass Audubon is the first private partner here, and she believes more organizations will sign on. And she also believes this this project is going to be good for the economy, too, because our natural world is a big part of the Massachusetts economy.
Yeah. Everybody loves to wander around in the natural world.
Right.
All right. CAI's Jeanette Barnes. Thank you, Jeanette.
All right. Thanks, Mindy.
Luckily, Hurricane Erin stayed offshore, but we did see some pretty big waves on south-facing beaches, particularly on the islands. Josh Balling from the Enquirer and Mirror joins us. Hi, Josh.
Good morning.
So how big did those waves get, and did we see any local flooding or other impact from Erin?
So far, we haven't seen too much flooding. There might have been a little bit last night late. The high tides were very late last night, and they will be again tonight. Some flooding downtown is expected, but nothing we haven't seen before, nothing we couldn't handle. But the yesterday and into today, the waves were very impressive. It's some of the biggest we've ever seen out here. I'd say probably some of the offshore 15 to 20 feet. Mm-hmm. Those are pretty powerful and along the South Shore. The town has closed, the lifeguards have closed the South Shore beaches to swimming since Wednesday. A couple of them even closed Tuesday due to the heavy surf and some pretty dangerous rip currents, which Harbor Master Sheila Lucy and even state officials were calling life-threatening. They don't want anybody really in the water on the South Shore. Even today, it's one of those, again, strange things that we get here when storms pass offshore. It's a beautiful sunny day, very breezy still, but you'd never know that a major hurricane was, a few hundred miles to the south, just southeast of us, and, coming our way, but well offshore, and not expected to really do much more than it is now, which is kick up a lot of surf. And haven't seen too much real erosion yet either, but we haven't gone out and done a full investigation yet, which we certainly plan to do.
So right now, is it just the south facing beaches that are closed?
Yeah, south-facing beaches, which is most of our swimming beaches are, and this time of year as well, a lot of the lifeguards that have been on duty all summer have headed home either to school or to college, so a couple of the North Shore beaches are not lifeguarded anyway, but they are certainly a lot less rough than the South Shore beaches. Jetty's Beach here on Nantucket has been open all week, open to swimmers. It's traditionally a very calm beach, a family-friendly beach, children's beach in town, same thing, and that actually doesn't have any lifeguards. It's one of the first beaches that the lifeguards are pulled from because it's such a calm beach to begin with.
Yeah. And of course, those riptides, they're going to continue to be a concern into the weekend. And I think I was hearing, don't go in, above your ankles kind of a thing. But for surfers, is it tempting, huh?
It is. And surfers, that's sort of, the town officials recognize and understand that surfers, for the most part, are some of the, you know, the most accomplished and powerful swimmers, and they have surfboards, and they don't, you know, they also, you know, they close the beaches to swimming, but they can't stop you from going in if you really want to. And there have been a lot of surfers out, and they've been basically doing just fine. They know how to handle rip currents. You know, the rip currents are the absolute worst for those who, you know, even for strong swimmers, they can usually, you know, you're supposed to swim parallel to the current. Don't try and fight the current, even if it takes you, you know, hundreds of yards down the beach. Eventually, it will peter out, and you can get in. But if you struggle to fight against the current, you're going to tire yourself out, and that's where the trouble starts. One thing that that has been a little bit problematic through all this is the boat cancellations. They started kind of in earnest yesterday afternoon, and now into this morning, everything's been canceled so far today. And I just took a quick look at the Steamship Authority website, and it's fine in Hyannis. Not too many people trying to come over. There's just six cars and one truck on standby at the Steamship Authority terminal there. But wait for it, 136 cars and 20 trucks on standby on Nantucket this morning.
Well, if you're going to get stranded somewhere, getting stranded on Nantucket's
not
such
a thing. And the question I had, too, is how many of those were on standby prior to the boats getting canceled? Because everybody's trying to get their cars off to, you know, at the end of the summer. This happens at this time every year, and it just gets compounded by the boats being canceled. Right. So, you know, I expect the Steamship Authority, as they have done traditionally in the past, will probably put an extra freight boat or two on if they can and try and get that backlog cleared up as soon as they can.
And then what is the fate of the food pantry, which needs to find a new home? We've talked about that, but, you know, this is a big problem. I mean, a lot of people have this image of everybody in Nantucket is wealthy, which is so not true. And this is a lot of people with food insecurity. This is a big problem.
This is a big problem. It's a big challenge. The food pantry is scrambling to find a new home. It's been operating out of a building downtown that was originally owned by the nonprofit Remain and then have sold to the town a few years ago. And it's not something that has just sprung upon the food pantry. It has known for a number of years since the town bought the building that it was going to have to find a new home. It's just been more difficult than expected to find one. And you hit the nail on the head before, is that the food security insecurity is a huge issue on Nantucket, as it is across the Cape and Islands and in other even wealthier communities around the state. The Greater Boston Food Bank did a study recently, and they provide a lot of food to our food pantry, so they included Nantucket in that study. And in the past couple of years, the number of people who have expressed some kind of food insecurity has gone from 1 in 5, which is still not very good at all, to 1 in 3. That doesn't mean that people don't have any food necessarily, but it means that they may be skipping meals. They may not be able to afford the most nutritious food they can. They rely on the schools' reduced and free lunch programs to take care of some of their children's needs during the school year. Any number of things. And the food pantry serves about 3,500 islanders a year. And when you consider our year-round population is somewhere at any given time around 12,000 to 15,000, maybe upwards of 20 at times, that's a lot of people.
Yeah, sure is.
And about 1,600 households, 3,500 islanders. It annually hands out about 20,000 bags of food. And they do it out of a relatively small space. Even if they weren't losing the space, they were going to need a larger space anyway. But just given, you know, the finite amount of building on Nantucket and the high cost of construction and high cost of real estate, it has proven more difficult than even, you know, they were optimistically anticipated. And so they're looking to find something by the end of April. And if they don't, they're going to have to change the way they operate. As manager Ruth Pitts told us last week, if this piece of property is not found, or a rental is not found that temporarily has the food pantry, it will cease to exist as it exists today. Doesn't mean it's going to go away, but it will not be able to serve its clients as it currently does. And whether that means serving less islanders, serving less, providing less nutritious food, right now it is able to provide fresh food, milk, bread, eggs, to its clients because it has refrigeration. It has the ability to do that. Chances are, if we can't find a location by the end of April, that's not going to happen. It's going to have to just provide canned goods and non-perishable food, and that's not a good thing either.
Well, let's keep our fingers crossed. Something breaks and they find a new home. Josh Balling from the Inquirer and Mirror. Thank you, Josh.
Thank you.
All right, we're going to move on to Sam Houghton from the Martha's Vineyard Times, who joins us. Hi, Sam.
Hey, Mindy.
Hey, Sam, before I get to what's in the paper this week, I wanted to ask you about Aaron and what you were seeing for waves there on your south beaches and if there's been any other impact.
Yeah, right. It's mostly south-facing beaches. As of yesterday, things didn't seem terrible. There have been some, wave washovers, but the dunes, from what we know so far, have mostly stayed intact. And if you remember a few years ago, those were really decimated at South Beach. But from what we are hearing, it's remained intact. But I think the thing to look out for, I guess, wave action is supposed to continue today. Mm-hmm. And the worry is some, there might be some worse erosion around high tide today. So people are really watching out. Similar to Nantucket, though, we've had some good surfing as well. We had some great photos of guys going out there and getting some pretty big waves with barrels. So that's been kind of fun.
I don't know. I'm staying out of the water. All right. Sam, you have this. You raised this question. Who's keeping track of tick-borne illnesses on the vineyard? And right now, it's a part-timer.
Yeah, part-timer, and I think even scarier, the funding for that is potentially drying up. We've been kind of looking into this question, who is keeping track of tick-borne illnesses, especially with this real boom with Lone Star and Alpha Gal. We found there's really just one public health nurse on the island that's tracking these. Health departments are really swamped with septic tank inspections, restaurant inspections, things like that. And this is Betsy Van Landingham. She's an infectious disease specialist, really decades of experience at the hospital. And she kind of keeps a statewide database up to date, kind of inputting all these symptomatic exposure information. But a little analysis just keeps tabs on patients to make sure they are, in fact, tick-related disease. But I think her work can provide, some research into these cases in general, start to better understand them, alpha, gal, and Lyme. Still so much we don't know about them. Especially alpha, gal, I'd say. Like, some people only have the allergy for a few months, others for years. Some reactions are really worse than others. But I think, her funding, she's only working 26 hours a week, supposed to be. Not only is she looking at tick-related illness, but other infectious disease too. But her funding was rescinded, and through the county, she has funding through June. But really, the question is, what's going to happen after that? And I think people are saying this is not the time to stop funding tick research.
And the thing is, I mean, the data that she's collecting seems pretty important, especially when we're seeing, more tick-borne illnesses and, it's not new, but relatively new, the Lone Star tick and what it carries. But she's also looking at other things like tularemia and, things that, mirror symptoms. I mean, it just seems like really important information.
Yeah, Powassan too. I mean, I think folks probably remember a really scary case on the island that I think underscored how bad this issue has become. A child, newborn, had Powassan. But and I think important to kind of keep tabs on those kind of things. And there's a lot of concern from the folks that we talked to. And it's pretty wild that it's not just her. There's one other. An epidemiologist that's really part-time works for the island. She also works on the Cape, another position that is also facing funding cuts. It's an epidemiologist that really focuses just on ticks, helping towns and medical practitioners understand what we understood was kind of the big picture and nuances of tick-borne disease.
If this funding goes away, is the job eliminated? And then does anybody do it?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a hope that, with the federal funding cuts, a lot is falling on states to kind of patch the holes. But with so much going on, there's a fear that, some other issues like ticks might fall through the cracks when there's bigger issues like, food security and education, things like that. Some might say ticks are a bigger deal, but so what they are saying is it could come down to local health departments or really just local funding that would help this out. But with health departments already kind of swamped, as we reported before, there's a real difficulty there.
Moving to a lighter story, the much anticipated annual agriculture fair coming, and a new company running it this year?
Fiesta, they're kind of, after 50 years, I think there's a new vendor coming in, Cushing Entertainment, I think did something like that, but did it for about 50 years, and there's a new company coming in. A big weekend for the island, the Ag Fair. There's also the fireworks in Oak Bluffs on Saturday. Illumination Night was last night. But the fair started yesterday, a four-day, big deal for the island. It's always a lot of fun. There was a little drama with the new vendors. Wasn't sure what kind of rides there will be. Unfortunately, there won't be a Ferris wheel this year. But I think, overall, everyone's excited.
No Ferris wheel. I'm okay with that. I don't like the Ferris wheel. To me, is one of the scariest rides there are.
fair enough. There's still plenty of rides that overall people are.
And I guess it's not that they've eliminated the Ferris wheel forever. I guess it's because there's another fair going on at the same time and they needed the Ferris wheel there. Yeah.
Right. There was kind of a last minute, getting these vendors was kind of, somewhat last minute. And they had already been doing a fair, I think, in Marshfield or something like that. So they had a little overlap. But still plenty of rides that they're bringing over.
Yeah. Ag Fair is a lot of fun, for sure. Yeah. All right. Sam Houghton with the Martha's Vineyard Times. Thank you, Sam.
Thank you, Mindy.
Coming up, it's pretty quiet at the State House, but there are issues percolating. We'll talk about it. Stay with us. You're listening to The Point and the Friday News Roundup. Community of Jesus and two other nonprofits are being accused of child labor and trafficking. Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle has that story. Hi, Tim.
Hi, Mindy.
So this is a civil suit filed in U.S. District Court in Boston.
That's correct. It was filed by an 18-year-old man named Oliver Ortolani, who grew up in the Community of Jesus in Orleans. And what he's alleging in this lawsuit is that the community forced children to work on several projects, and including the construction of the Performing Arts Building that was opened a couple years ago in Brewster. He's claiming that the children were forced to get up early every morning, work 9 to 16 hours a day without the proper safety gear, and that if they complained, they could be assaulted, shunned by the community, and basically, he's claiming that the children were used in this manner in order for the community to save money on the construction cost of this performing arts center.
What's been the reaction from the Community of Jesus?
Well, their attorney, who we contacted, called the suit frivolous. He said that Mr. Ortolani's parents, who were both involved in the Community of Jesus and were part of the construction team, had given permission for their son to work on this project, and that their attorney, his name is Jeff Robbins, basically claimed that this was more of an issue between Mr. Ortolani and his parents, and not really, and he denied all of the charges that were contained in the lawsuit.
All right, so definitely more to come on this one. And now there are some in Chatham who are saying that the gateway to their community needs some sprucing up.
Sure. It's in South Chatham, where the main sort of feeder road into Chatham off of Route 6 is Route 137 that goes from the highway through East Harwich to Route 28 in South Chatham. But right at that intersection of Route 28, the town has built a very large sewage pump station. And at this point, it's pretty stark. They clear cut a large swath of property and built this sewage pump station surrounded by a black chain link fence. And South Chatham residents say that it is just very unsightly, and they're concerned that the town is not paying attention to South Chatham. This has been a longstanding sort of dispute. They point out that there are pump stations located in the downtown area that are nicely landscaped with a nice granite facing on the the foundations, sort of camouflaging on the mechanical devices there, and that in South Chatham they just they're just sort of being left out to have this sort of unsightly pump station right in the middle of their community.
So they're looking for some landscaping. Is that what they're hoping for?
Yeah, they say that it wouldn't take a lot to sort of screen this pump station from the highway, from the road. And they just feel that, you know, the town has sort of dragged its feet on doing this over the past few years. This pump station has been in place for a while now. And it is one of the larger pump stations in town. The town's DPW director said they do have plans for landscaping, but they haven't executed them yet because of partly because of the weather we've been having. It's not a good hasn't been a good time to do planting.
Yeah, the heat. I'll die. And just quickly, over in Harwich, an anonymous donor making a hefty donation to complete the Fire Association's historic preservation of the former fire station on Bank Street.
Yeah, the Harwich Fire Association's been working on this project for a number of years to convert the old Bank Street Fire Station into sort of a museum and meeting place, and also three affordable apartments. And an anonymous donor has contributed $50,000 as a matching gift to help complete the project. So the Fire Association is kind of putting the word out there, looking for donations to match this gift. If they've gotten a lot of support from the community and the town on this, and they say if they can get this matching gift, then that will put them on the road to completing this this long gestating project.
All right. Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle. As always, thank you, Tim.
Thank you, Mindy.
Pretty quiet time around the State House, but there are some issues percolating. Craig Zandler from State House News joins us. Hey, Craig.
Good to talk to you, Mindy.
So one of those issues is how the legislature will respond to Governor Healey's recent health care budget that also contains some important policy riders aimed at responding to federal policy changes. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah, it's really, in a lot of ways, the most interesting issue on my mind and probably the minds of a lot of people in the building these days. She filed at the end of last week what's called a closeout budget to sort of close out accounts for the fiscal year that just ended. It contains $2 billion in Medicaid funding. Most of that is going to get reimbursed by the federal government. And even though it's $2 billion, the spending part isn't the most intriguing part. The intriguing part is the creation of economic resiliency and federal response fund from the capital gains tax. And what that really means is a pool of money, a pretty amorphous pool of money, to allow the administration to make up for these ongoing spending cuts we saw in the big beautiful bill and the kinds of cuts that we're probably likely to see more of. Mm-hmm. So whether it's water quality or libraries or teacher stipends, whatever it is that's getting cut in Washington, this would give the administration and the legislature the ability to close some of those gaps. They are not going to be able to close all of them. Another rider in that bill really packs off wind power, basically closes down any expansion of the administration's ambitions to make wind power a real part of the clean energy mix until after the next presidential election, literally suspends our targets for wind power until 2029. And guess what? That's after the next presidential election.
Yeah, more to come on that. Yeah. So school starting soon. And the question remains, will we have a statewide cell phone ban?
We will not have a statewide cell phone ban next week, right?
Right.
However, the Senate has clearly spoken and adopted a statewide policy that all districts have to implement plans to keep phones out of the hands of students during school hours. But it's the legislature. That's just the Senate. And the House has yet to take any action. More importantly, the reality of the Massachusetts legislature these days is that the only thing that really matters in the House is the point of view of the House Speaker. Mm-hmm. Now, John Mariano from Quincy. Now, he is driven. He's informed by the opinions of his members who do hear from their constituents. I mean, it's not totally undemocratic, as is sometimes presented. However, what he says does go in that chamber. Mm-hmm. And he's been wishy-washy on the issue of cell phones. He said, yeah, that's something we should really look at, but But if they wanted to do it, they may well have done it by now. He would have said something definitive. He would have sent different signals on the issue. Now, the Senate bill would implement the ban in for the 2026 school year. Should the House decide to go ahead and do this when they come back, either in the fall, the winter, the spring, if they adopt it in this session, the House, that is, probably also be 2026. How different it might be from the Senate, and whether they would have one of their patented endless conference committee fights over it, I could not tell you. It's not entirely impossible that this will be a bargaining chip. The Senate really wants the cell phone ban, but what the House really wants is reform of the Cannabis Control Commission. And the Senate was really wishy-washy when the House passed the Cannabis Control Commission reform bill. And, you know, that agency has kind of been something of a mess for going on 4 years now. The House passed a bill to reform that commission. It's over in the Senate. The Senate hasn't done anything with that. I don't know by any means that it's going to be one for one. You act on the cell phone bill, we'll act on the Cannabis Control Commission, but it's classic. It's exactly the kind of thing that does happen.
And what about replacement for MCAS? Is there any conversation on that?
That's another fascinating issue to keep an eye on, but you can't get anything definitive, and I don't pretend to have gone deeply into the politics of it. But you definitely had the Mass Teachers Association, you know, run the campaign to end it as a high school requirement. You've got the education, the state education department that never wanted to do that anyway, and does want districts to come up with something coherent and pretty uniform that takes the place of MCAS to certify that students have really learned the curriculum. But right now, it doesn't seem at all to be off the we need to have serious discussion stages. We need to organize our discussions about this. We need to hear from all stakeholders. It's been a long time since there was a story on the news service that had anything interesting and definitive about, I won't call it MCAS 2.0 because I don't think we're going to see that, but the next gen MCAS.
And then finally, lottery revenues and profits are down. What do we think is at the heart of this issue?
Yeah, you know, we saw sports betting get approved in Massachusetts. We saw online gambling get approved in Massachusetts. And with each step, you said, well, this is definitely going to be a competitive threat to the lottery. And the difference between the lottery and casinos and online betting and sports betting is that those other three streams of gaming revenue, those go into the pockets of the shareholders and the owners, much more so than the lottery does. I mean, revenues from the other forms of gaming are up, but lottery sales were down 3% last year, and the lottery profit was down 8% last year, and that's basically unprecedented. Mm. I've been waiting for a long time and predicting doom for quite a while for the lottery, and it hasn't happened. Mm. Every year they've managed to keep their sales good. They've managed to keep their profits good, and profits go to local aid. The lottery was set up to support schools, unlike Encore Casino, I can tell you that much.
Yeah.
And so that's the difference with the lottery. You know, as a public-minded person, you have to be very concerned if there's any downturn in the performance of the lottery. And it's 1 year, but sure, it's time to be a little concerned.
Yeah, for sure. All right, Craig Sandler from the State House News. Thank you so much, Craig.
Total pleasure. Nice talking to you, Mindy.
Coming up after the break, Provincetown students and their pen pals from Alaska. Listening to the news roundup on The Point, the owners of the hotel and entertainment venue Pilgrim House in Provincetown are embroiled in a legal battle with each other over alleged fraud and mismanagement. And wrapped up in that legal battle is a very famous puppet named Madam. Tyler Jaeger of the Provincetown Independent talks with CAI's Gilda Geist about the legal battle and what it could mean for Madam's future.
Who are the owners of the Pilgrim House, and why are they suing each other?
So the owners of the Pilgrim House are two couples, the first being Maria Serino, who is a venture capitalist based originally in Boston, and her partner, Elizabeth Barbo. And then they are the sort of silent partners in a business arrangement with the two other owners who are responsible for its day-to-day operations of the hotel, and that's Ken Horgan and Kevin Scott Benty. They are suing each other. The instigator of this was Serino and Barbo. Serino alleged that Horgan and Benti misappropriated funds that were rightly belonging to the Pilgrim House's hotel account, and that they spent those funds on their other businesses and on personal expenses. They also allege that the two have blocked the sale of the hotel, as Cirino and Barbo would like to sell the property. So then the other couple is countersuing Cirino and Barbo for defamation and for tortious interference.
Who is Madam? I understand she's had a very illustrious career along with her creator, Waylon Flowers.
Waylon, did you realize that if Mr. Clean married Mrs. Olson, they would have an immaculate reception?
Yes, Madam is a personality and also a puppet and a presence on mainstream American TV dating all the way back to the 1970s when she was created by a performer named Waylon Flowers. Madam was a character, sort of this extravagant female puppet who had a personality akin to classic Hollywood figures and Broadway legends and scream queens of the early 20th century, and would appear on a bunch of television shows throughout the 70s and perform a sort of style and sense of humor that was pretty transgressive for the time.
Here's an etiquette tip from Madam. When dancing cheek to cheek, be sure to face your partner.
Including on shows like The Hollywood Square, Solid Gold, The Laugh-In. And then after Flowers died from complications of AIDS in the late 1980s, the rights to Madam went to his longtime manager and friend, Marlena Shilovitz.
What is the connection between Madam and the Pilgrim House?
Yeah, so between Flowers' death and the present, Shilovitz took the Madam act to a couple different places. She had a couple tributes in museums and with other performers. But then in 2021, she signed an agreement with the couple who are co-owners of the Pilgrim House, Horgan and Benti, to bring the act back to Provincetown. This was pitched as a bit of a homecoming for Madam because very early in his career, Flowers had performed with the puppet at the same venue at the Pilgrim House in the 1970s. So once that agreement was signed, it was to share the usage rights, the intellectual property and physical property of Madam, and bring the puppets to the Pilgrim House and to train puppeteers to work with the act, sort of in a way inspired by Flowers' performances.
What does that have to do with the lawsuits?
2 years after they had this agreement, Shilovitz and the two co-owners of the Pilgrim House, she actually filed a suit of her own against them that was eventually settled out of court this year. That suit originally alleged that Madam had been not handled in the way that she'd intended when she originally signed the agreement. But for this lawsuit with the Pilgrim House co-owners, Horgan is the only of the co-owners that is listed as a owner of the LLC that controls Madam. So if he is removed from the hotel as a manager, or if the hotel is sold, then the sort of conceit for bringing this historic act and part of queer history to Provincetown is lost. At the same time, the business that is controlling the intellectual property for Madam, Madam LLC, is one of the businesses that Cirino and Barbo are saying the other couple who co-own the hotel improperly funneled funds. That suit between the two couples who co-own the hotel faces an outgoing deadline on September 2nd for Horgan and Benti to answer a complaint that the other two have that they should be found in contempt of court for missing a deadline to release bank statements from the hotel.
That's Tyler Jaeger of the Provincetown Independent. Tyler, thank you so much.
Always a pleasure, Gilda.
I once was a merry mermaid with nary a fret or frown. I'd quietly cry to the ships passing by. Hi, sailor! New in town!
Remember Madam well. Provincetown and the Bering Sea coastal village of Muktuvik are just as far away as two places can be in the United States, but students in both communities have found one big piece of common ground: growing up in a rapidly changing climate. Alaska's KYUK's Samantha Watson visited with students in both Alaska and Massachusetts to hear what it means to be in communication with other kids about climate change.
In a classroom at the Provincetown IB school, a group of middle school students squished together for a video call with their pen pals from Muktuvik, Alaska.
How is the erosion affecting your land?
Over time, because of erosion and whatnot,
12-year-old John Gunn from Provincetown answers a question from junior Jojean George about erosion in the East Coast community.
Because, Provincetown will eventually become an island because that part that connects us is slowly narrowing.
Provincetown is the very last community on the Hook-shaped Peninsula of Cape Cod. The seaside community of 3,000 can swell to triple that in the summer months, attracting visitors to its vibrant art scene and proud LGBTQ+ community. Despite being nearly 4,000 miles away from each other, the students from Oktavik and Provincetown have common ground. Provincetown faces coastal erosion and increased flooding because of climate change. It's something their pen pals can understand. The Alaska students are originally from the village of Newtok, a place that no longer really exists. The Bering Sea coastal village steadily deteriorated due to permafrost thaw. The ground sank, and the Ninglick River washed away 70 feet of shoreline each year. In October, after a tribal council vote, the last residents of Newtok were relocated to Maktavik. Each group of students have learned a lot about the other in their exchange of emails, photos, and Zoom calls, like this one. 13-year-old Bella Vertvin says the class wondered in their letters how moving solved the erosion problem for the Alaska village.
How is Murtavik safer than Newtok if it's just 9 miles away, and how do you know that Murtavik isn't going to erode as well as Newtok did?
Do you remember what they said? Do you remember their answer? Or if they had an answer?
I remember the answer, which was that Newtok was very flat on the ground and was kind of like elevated, but it was still pretty flat. But Murtavik is on, like they said, it's like these rolling hills. Like this.
Murtavik is also more stable because it's built on rock instead of permafrost and dirt. And this is something the Provincetown kids can grasp pretty well because their community is built on sand. And Provincetown's own history is rooted in a story of relocation. When the Mayflower landed in Provincetown, colonists settled in a place where they couldn't grow food, so they had to move.
So they floated all of their houses over.
I'm sitting with Bella Vertvin by the beach outside of her old house, looking out at the wide Atlantic Ocean. The wooden house behind us was floated across an ocean inlet in the 1850s, nearly 200 years ago.
And they used to say the bay was so calm that the housewives could cook a meal in the kitchen while they were coming across.
Now, the community faces existential threats from the ocean. Since 2018, coastal flooding during the winter storms has become more frequent. City management says the town is now looking in part at a vertical relocation to survive, with owners of coastline houses raising their homes on stilts if they can afford it. Being a kid in Provincetown involves pier jumping after sailing camp, sand dune sledding when there's snow. It also means grappling with the tangibility of a changing climate. Bella says that means sometimes going to school prepared for a disaster.
If I went to school on a day that we had been flooded or a weekend or flooding is happening, I would wear two pairs of pants, two pairs of sweaters. I would bring a kind of pack of clothes with me to school.
During a winter storm in 2020, Bella's home flooded. She talks about returning home to chaos of rugs and chairs strewn about, seaweed and ocean debris in the streets. It was right when she moved to Provincetown. Then the flooding kept happening.
Because I was like, oh, we've done this before. But then it started getting like over and over and over and over again. So it was just like interfering kind of with like day-to-day life.
Eventually, her family sold the house that was floated across the bay. But flooding is still something Bella says she thinks about a lot. She's been developing an idea for a breakwall barrier that could harness the power of storm waves. But she says climate change is something most kids her age don't get in the same way. But the Maktavik kids do.
It makes me so happy talking to people who understand, like, climate change is happening. Climate change is really bad and we need to do something. Or bye-bye human civilization.
She says it's made her connection with 17-year-old pen pal Glenisha Carl meaningful. Like a mentorship. Here's Carl.
Since when they mentioned flooding, I thought about Newtok, because Newtok is a place to flood all year long. Like, every summer it floods, every fall it floods.
In her letters to Bella, Carl says she wrote about Typhoon Murbach, about leaving her home in Newtok, about returning last fall through the Pen Pal Project to take pictures.
Like, I could feel like it was my home, but not my home.
She says memories rushed back to her, like fishing with her friend in the pond behind her old house.
There's no more pond. There's no more fish. Like, that's a whole new environment.
In their correspondence, the two groups also wrote about their favorite music and what they like to do for fun. It's a kid-woven tapestry of Billie Eilish, squid and salmon fishing, and coastal erosion. Earlier this year, their stories as kids impacted by climate change got to live beyond their own inboxes. The students' letters and photos were selected for display at a photography exhibition in New York City. Both groups of students traveled to the Big Apple to meet in person for the first time. In Provincetown, I'm Samantha Watson.
And this story was brought to us in collaboration with KYUK in Bethel, Alaska. You can see photos at our website, capeandislands.org. We have a few minutes left, so we thought we would revisit CAI's John Basile's latest sitting-in interview, this one with Tim Sweeney, who's taken up the baritone ukulele, a bit different than the small uke many people are familiar with.
Welcome to Sittin' In. I'm John Basile. Every so often, I like to check in with Cape-based musician Tim Sweeney. He's been a popular performer in the area for years, first as a singer and guitarist, and recently he's become an advocate for the ukulele. Now Tim has taken on another challenge, the baritone ukulele. Let's let him explain.
It's tuned like a guitar, but, and I poo-pooed this for the longest time because I'm teaching ukulele. I can't have a baritone in my class because I know it's different chords, you know, different notes, and you can't have that. So I was always like this, no, no, no. Well, a former bandmate and friend of mine came by my store and dropped, he said, I don't know what this is, but you should have it. He dropped it off. And it turned out to be like a Sears Silvertone baritone. It was all dusty and beat up, and I had to wait a whole week to get strings from my dealer. And then I strung it up, and John, I'll tell you, I cleaned it up. It looked great. I put it in the corner in my living room where I have other instruments and stands. And it was about 3 weeks later, I said, get up and do something with that. So I started looking for songs that I either liked the melody, always wanted to learn how to play, more intricate arrangements and things like that. And it turns out a whole bunch of them fit into this yacht rock category, like Baby, I Love Your Way, What's Going On, Just the Way You Are, all New York State of Mind. I never thought I'd be singing that.
So in a way, the instrument is impacting the choice of your material.
Just as it always has. When I first started at 19, I was playing guitar, and I was learning chords and songs off of Bob Dylan, Peter, Paul, and Mary records. And then I had that whole thing. So it's just like when I started playing uke and I picked out all those great songs from the American Songbook. And it was all about my dad. It was all about those songs which I was weaned on from a teenager because I heard them around the house and him singing, you know, shaving and the sounds coming down the stairway in our old Cape Cod house, you know.
So now that we've heard about the baritone uke and yacht rock, let's hear some music from Tim Sweeney.
I was dreaming of the night. Would it turn out right? How do you tell you, girl?
And you can hear more at timsweeney.us. And that wraps up this week's edition of the News Roundup. I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.